Welcome to Manifesto, a podcast. Your regular visit to the archives of vanity, where men and women who stop making myths turn to issuing proclamations. Your guides for this journey, my co-host Phil Klei, me, Jacob Siegel, the knocker off of tall hats, and our guest this week, Tara Isabella Burton. May you continue to be a person.
Today we're very excited to have Tara Isabella Burton with us. She's the author of the novels Social Creature, The World Cannot Give, and Here in Avalon from Simon & Schuster, as well as the nonfiction books Strange Rites, New Religions for a Godless World, and Self-Made, Curating Our Image from Da Vinci to the Kardashians. She's a visiting fellow at George Mason University's Mercatus Center, and also just somebody I find to be a fascinating thinker, someone who's articulated the way in which religious yearnings get funneled into strange new forms in our secular age, and who as a fiction writer is attentive to the transcendent as well as to the dangerous paths the yearning for the transcendent can take us down. Our manifesto for today is J.R.R. Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, originally delivered as a lecture in 1938. Tolkien, of course, is the great fantasy writer, author of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and if you haven't read On Fairy Stories, I strongly recommend it, especially if you're a fan of his. Our art for today is Goblin Market, a narrative poem by Christina Rossetti, first published in 1862. Rossetti was an English writer associated with the Pre-Raphaelite movement. Her brother is Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the poet and illustrator and painter, and she's in several of his paintings. If you're not familiar with the poem, my recommendation is to read it without any knowledge of what it's about, because it will throw you for a loop. Also, Manifesto is now sponsored by Fairfield University, a Jesuit university in Fairfield, Connecticut. Fairfield's mission is to develop the creative, intellectual potential of students and to foster in them ethical and religious values and a sense of social responsibility. I teach there in both the undergraduate English department and in their Master of Fine Arts and Creative Writing program. We are very pleased to be associated with Fairfield and thank them for their sponsorship, and also thank Fairfield student Reese Rano for being our engineer.
You do, Tara, but I have no doubt about your personhood. So it's a pleasure to have you here in full bloom of personage. And what a wonderful choice. I hadn't read either of these before. And since we're starting off with the Tolkien, why did you choose this? Why Tolkien? Why On Fairy Stories? What led you here?
So I've spent the past few years working on a novel that is not a fairy tale exactly, but is about fairy tales. And one of the things that kind of I find myself struggling with, both as a novelist and as a novelist of faith, and as a novelist who is very obsessed with and afraid of the idea of enchantment, I was interested in this piece precisely because I think it wrestles with, from a slightly different perspective, the same questions that I find myself wrestling with all the time, especially sort of implicitly below the surface. You know, am I creating something real? Am I co-creating something? Am I creating some kind of secondary world? And if I'm creating it, is it an illusion? And am I just doing something that is not philosophy, that is therefore a waste of everybody's words and times and attention? And I think this particular manifesto wrestles from, in Tolkien's case, a Catholic perspective with what the ground of certain kinds of storytelling is all about and how that relates to a sense, romantic, affective, or otherwise, of enchantment. And as someone who is often enchanted, and sometimes worryingly enchanted by bad things, and yet sort of would like to be even more enchanted than I am in our quote-unquote disenchanted age, and we can debate that imminently, I find thinking about fairy tales, or the particular definition of fairy tales that Tolkien, I wouldn't even say has, sort of creates by cutting off other potential fairy tales from his definition, is seems like a very good place to start.
But it's very convincingly, right? So his taxonomy, his arrival at what a fairy tale is, which is he eliminates other sort of related
beast
forms.
Yeah.
Beast fables, meaning like stories with talking animals, essentially, travelers' stories, like Gulliver's Travelers, this sort of enchanted travelogue or the journey to a strange enchanted place. He cuts that out. He cuts out the beast fable. But he does so for reasons that seem not merely, first of all, not arbitrary, but also not merely aesthetic. Like, there is a substantive unity to the experiential and maybe even ontological or imaginative quality of the kind of story that he's describing that is not simply a matter of genre classification in a kind of, you know, like pedantic, the fairy tale is too cool to be, you know, not, you know, because look, let's just say up front that as somebody who is familiar with like the intense nerdery that could attend to, is this sci-fi or is this, that's where I'm coming from, right? I'm coming to this as a sci-fi person who thought I was too cool for fantasy, which I thought was like maybe suspiciously girly even, or like too like virginal, you know, like sci-fi was like more like macho in some way because it like there were armies and robots, and like fantasy was like a little bit too like acne and virginal and all. I mean, this is really my background, but like certainly Tolkien is transcending that kind of mere genre snobbery. Can I just say, I think it's an absolutely amazing essay.
It's incredible.
We're not like dispassionate analysts here. And I thought it was incredible, full of like just every line like seems to contain a wise and original judgment. Like,
yeah,
he's just on these throwaway lines.
There's so many different kinds.
Yeah, constantly, yeah. Like in little throwaway lines, but they're the throwaway line itself is like containing some sort of astute judgment of something in the world. Right. It's amazing.
History often resembles myth because they are both ultimately of the same stuff. Or, small wonder that spell means both a story told and a formula of power over living men. Or,
yes,
nature is no doubt a life study, or a study for eternity for those so gifted. But there is a part of man which is not nature, and which therefore is not obliged to study it, and is, in fact, wholly unsatisfied by it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's great.
By the way, that feels like a manifesto for your entire like literary project, Tara. Because you know, the first novel of yours I wrote is I'm going to screw up the title.
The world cannot give.
The world cannot give. I was about to say the world is not enough, but I was like, no, that's wrong. The world cannot give.
That seems fun.
Yeah. And then your latest novel here in Avalon is like this. It's like a pair of sisters, and one of this is just kind of like hungry search for meaning and depth. Seems to find it in this like cultish group called Avalon. I mean, is that a fair characterization of like one of your driving creative forces?
Absolutely. I think sort of on a personal level, I am someone who kind of, like many nerdy ex-theater kids, came to a love of writing and literature through a sort of generalized love of beauty or a desire for enchantment or transcendence that when you are 13 years old, doesn't have a specific direction or even kind of a moral valence. It's just all effect and affect all of the time. And I think as I've gotten older and as my own pull towards enchantment kind of has found itself more specifically within, well, within Christianity, but also within a sort of moral view of the world, the question that I find sort of most interesting and tense is how you kind of reconcile a love of beauty with a love of goodness. So that the sort like question one is this sort of hunger for meaning or meaningfulness or transcendence. But I'm interested too in the ways in which trying to follow those desires sort of in and of themselves might lead us to places that are a little bit different from the real world, perhaps a little bit more enchanted in some ways in the case of Avalon, but potentially quite horrific in others. I'm interested in that the realms of bad or imperfect yeah. enchantment that come from, I think, a deeply felt and real place, which is the desire to find something.
You know, and one of the things when he's making his taxonomy of what a fairy story is, he makes the point that supernatural is not the right word. for fairy stories, because to fairies it can hardly be applied unless super is taken merely as a superlative prefix, for it is man who is, in contrast to fairies, supernatural, and often of diminutive stature, whereas they are natural, far more natural than he. Such is their doom. The road to fairyland is not the road to heaven, nor even to hell, I believe, though some have held that it may lead thither indirectly by the devil's tithe.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I find so fascinating about fairies. And I don't, Avalon was not written as a fairy tale downstream of Toka's manifesto, although this manifesto was hugely helpful to me when I was writing.
Oh, fantastic. I sort of especially the
sort of sections towards the end about Eouk's catastrophe that we'll get to later. But the thing that interested me about the way that, for starters, Avalon does not contain literal fairies exactly, but the Avalon as a sort of cult slash theater troupe slash whatever it is needs to be understood, or I understood it as a kind of secular, non-supernatural fairyland. And the thing that interests me about fairies is precisely that it's sort of neither heaven nor hell, that they are in some way morally neutral because they're outside of something very specific about humanity and being human. And that's not, it's not like, I think a lot of fairy tales or retellings will focus on beauty or their sort of unattainability or just a sense that what they are is luring you out of life through being beautiful and mysterious. But I think that there's another element of fairyland, which is the simultaneous sort of, it's not a sexual beauty. Like fairies are not vampires. The way that fairies sort of seduce people is not like a purely erotic seduction in the way that you find in like gothic stories of women swooning, you know, in
Sheridan Le Fanu, the vampire's touch. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. It's like fairies have this completely childlike quality that they sort of don't enter into human moral responsibility. They can sort of dance all night and exist in this community of their friends, and they seduce either children or people who sort of want to become childlike again. But they never, because they can't grow up in a certain sense, or because they're always free.
I think it's because it's before the fall, and so
exactly.
Tolkien's distinction that he makes that's crucial here, I think, is that the fairy story is not really about the fairy. It's about the human being entering the place, which is the fairy land, you know, and even like the spelling of fairy land, F-A-E, you know, R-I-E, or is it F-A-E-I-R-I-E? But in either case, you know, the sort of prelapsarian quality of even the spelling, like it suggests what it is about this place that is enchanted and that is seductive and beautiful in that way. And I think it's, you know, the line Phil read about how the fairy is more natural than the man is because there is a organic unity in this recovered world before. So like, I'd never quite articulated this to myself before, but like, what is the difference between fantasy and sci-fi? Right? I'm sorry to be like a sci-fi nerd about this, but I have thought about that in technical terms before, and sci-fi people will point out like, oh, it's about technology, you know, or there's some scientific thing, and it's not about sort of alternative natural worlds. But this is actually sort of the crucial point in a sense, and it's how they are different in kind, is that science fiction is about a sort of potentiality that is telling you something about what the human has become, right? Through its speculative character, nominally what the human could become, it's actually telling you like what the human has become. Fantasy is like a recovered almost anamnesis, like here is what we once were and still truly are in some like deep, deep sense, like in the deepest depths of yourself, in some enchanted forest in the collective human soul, there is this prelapsarian existence. And the fairy is like the sort of organic, not quite human, almost human part of nature, but able to communicate with men, like an elven intermediary between the fully constructed human and the animal world of the dark enchanted forest.
So he has a line about science fiction. Well, where he says, he's talking about science fiction of his time. He says, these prophets often foretell, and many seem to yearn for, a world like one big glass-roofed railway station. For them, it is, as a rule, very hard to gather what men in such a world town will do. But they might use their freedom mainly, it would appear, in order to play with mechanical toys in the soon cloying game of moving at high speed.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And the fairy would be related to that part of man, which does not fit in that world at all, right? Is sort of to which that is alien.
What I find so interesting, though, about Tolkien in particular, is precisely the way that some of these conceptions of fantasy as recovery come out so intensely out of like a 19th century romanticism and romantic nationalism. Mm. And this sort of, whether we're thinking of Wagner, we're thinking of the Brothers Grimm, the sort of mid to late 19th century obsession with finding the pre-urban, pre-modern, not lapsarian theologically, but according to a particular account of human progress and destruction, you know, can we find the real heart of, you know, German folklore? Can we find the real heart of who human beings are outside of quote unquote liberal modernity or the Industrial Revolution or cities? And that's sort of, I feel like, a piece of the puzzle in Tolkien, like Lewis writing, not just a few generations later, but in the case of this 1939, I think is the first time that the lecture on fairy stories gets delivered. And so an interesting question that I think that Tolkien is subtextually bringing up is not just the question of what do we think about fairy stories, but what does recovery of something pure and good and meaningful through this realm of fantasy look like, specifically from a Christian perspective, but from a Christian perspective that is also looking for theological unity, not just a kind of the story of a particular people or a particular nation or a particular folk. Like, what is truly us as human, rather than what is truly the story of our people? And I think for me, that tension makes, like, really complicates Tolkien's obsession with the imagined, like, what is actually in that fantasy realm? And again, how do we identify goodness in it becomes more palpable.
It also puts him in line, by the way, with a lot of the modernists, right? Who you wouldn't pair with, because there is this sort of obsession with, you know, there's a great Guy Davenport essay called The Symbol of the Archaic, where he's talking about how much prehistory has been important to the modern art of the 20th century and to the modernists and to Proust, to Picasso, right, to all these others. And he writes, behind all this passion for the archaic, which is far more pervasive in the arts of our time than can be suggested here, is a longing for something lost, for energies, values, and certainties unwisely abandoned by an industrial age. Things, Proust says, are gods, and one way our arts seem to regard our world is to question what gods have come to dwell among us in the internal combustion engine, the cash register, and the computer.
There's a whole political valence to this, which is a bit esoteric, but maybe worth bringing up here, which is that the, you know, two decades before Tolkien is writing this, there's a movement of the non-Bolshevik, non-Orthodox Marxist alternative socialisms in both America and Britain. So people like Herbert Croly, Randolph Bourne in America, H.G. Wells, Fabianism in England, where part of what they are trying to imagine through, it's a contradiction that seems so strange to us now, but part of what they're trying to imagine through a kind of engineered technocracy is actually a return to what they imagined to be a medieval communist utopia, right? So there was a medieval, not all of them believe this, but this comes up repeatedly. It's a sort of motif. There's an idea that there was a medieval communalism, like a pre-industrial medieval communal, I'm talking about like political economy also, right? Not just social relations, but there was some more just, more organic community of sharing in wherever it was, in the Shire in England, or, you know, whatever, wherever it was. And so they have this in mind. I feel like And Tara, you know, you were talking about recovery and Tolkien, right? Recovery is one of the things he says fairy stories do specifically. It's like recovery, escape, joy, and I forget what the other one is.
There's literary quality, recovery, consolation, and escape.
And consolation, I think, is joy in the sense that he's using it there.
Yeah.
And that's that you catastrophe that we can talk more about. But to stay with recovery for a second, like, it seems to me that, man, there's so much in this essay, it's hard to, you know. Okay, so there's a part of the essay towards the end. So I'm trying not to get diverted into other parts that I want to talk about. There's a part of the essay toward the end where he's talking about the relationship between myth and fairy stories and forces of nature, celestial bodies and events. And he's sort of dispatching these theories that are contemporary to, I think more or less contemporary to when he's writing, you know, one theory being that myths evolved out of primitive people sort of bottom up. And then the other theory being a sort of top-down
thing. This is the idea. It's like, oh, there's lightning. Well, maybe there's like a big man in the cloud and he's throwing lightning bolts down.
So that's the primitive bottom-up
one. He's like, that's not how it happened at all.
But then he also says that the top-down one, which is starts off, there's lightning in the sky. We give lightning a name. Then there's sort of additional details accrete to the name that we gave to lightning. And those additional details develop a personality, and that personality becomes a myth. I might be getting that wrong, but I think it's sort of something along those lines. And he says both of those are wrong, right? And this, ultimately, his understanding of how myth and the natural world and fairy tales relate to each other is ultimately a Christian perspective. And it's a Christian perspective that ultimately these are created stories from created beings. And this is why I think, I hope I'm not wrong, Tolkien didn't his myths of the Shire didn't evolve into a kind of fascistic nationalism, because he had a Christian moral ethic rooting this. Tell me he didn't go fascist, did he?
No.
Okay, good. Yeah. All right. Thank you. So this, I think, maybe in part explains why, even though, Tara, like you're saying, like, there is that sort of romantic pre-industrial recovery of what had been lost in the nation element in him also, it's connected to this Christian ethic.
Which you can see going overtly fascist in Pound, in Yeats, in a lot of other people who are invested in similar ideas, right?
I mean, I think what the thing that any kind of Christian writer, particularly a Christian writer dealing with stories, has to contend with, and this is why I think, and Tolkien does this not just very well, but grounds his essay in this, is what is the relationship of stories to the big story,
right?
To the incarnation, the resurrection, to the Bible. Like, I think a sort of you do have to take that as the only fully true story. If you are a Christian writer of fiction. And then the question of what do these other stories do or point to? Are they only true insofar as they participate in this sort of greater reality? And I think precisely Tolkien's comments on eucatastrophe, on the kind of importance of the sort
Terry,
of, not just the happy ending.
Explain that term, please. Eucatastrophe. What does that mean?
Eucatastrophe. Sort of It's literally happy catastrophe or happy accident. It's the opposite of the moment of realization in tragedy. And I think actually Tolkien really sees the fairy tale as the opposite of the tragedy in a way that structures his whole account of fairy tale. So the moment in you know your Greek tragedy where Oedipus realizes that he's killed his father and married his mother, that is the sort of the turning point of tragic recognition.
It's a bummer.
Yeah. But it's also the kind of the linchpin of the whole narrative. Whereas for Tolkien, I can't keep saying it. I keep coughing when I say it. Eucatastrophe is a kind of hopeful recognition, even sometimes in the person of the unexpected happy ending, the happy surprise. And Tolkien writes, in the Eucatastrophe, we see in a brief vision that the answer, the truth of the world, may be greater. It may be a far off gleam or echo of evangelium in the real world.
There's also a bit, because he states right quite directly, like the birth of Christ is the Eucatastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the Eucatastrophe of the story of the incarnation. And he says, this story begins and ends in joy. It has preeminently the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. For the art of it has the supremely convincing tone of primary art, that is, of creation. To reject it leads either to sadness or to wrath.
So, I mean, that reminds me in writerly terms and stylistic terms, what's so great about this essay, totally different writing style, completely different voice, subject matter couldn't be different, but it reminded me in a way of a Naipaul essay we discussed on here years ago, Jacques Soustelle and the Decline of the West.
All right, yeah.
Insofar as it achieves this kind of, I wish I had a better way to describe it, but a kind of metonymic resonance between the thing it's describing and at the line level, what it is evoking of the thing it's describing. So like the conceptual and the experiential harmonize in a way that produces like this resonance that is greater than either one of them, except that whereas Naipaul does it through the shape of the story, through the narrative, through the characterization of Jacques Soustelle and this guy, Jacques Soustelle, and then his motion through the world and through his own life, Tolkien is doing it like in these like judgments that are like one line, but then it contains so much in this one line, it expands out into some vast new way of seeing the world where like, you can glimpse this quality of enchantment or whatever it is that he's describing in the one line. And he evokes this feel, for me as a reader, it evokes this feeling that is confirming the kind of formal claim that he's making. Like I keep feeling the thing that he is telling me is the case. Like even when he was talking about, I don't know for you guys, but for me, the fantasy stuff I did, like he says that when he was a kid, didn't really do it for him, and like seafaring stories weren't his thing. And I forget what the other one he says wasn't so much his thing was, but then he says the thing that really got him was like the dark enchanted forest. And he says this in a much smarter and more elegant way than I'm saying it, obviously, but
he also says that his love of fairy stories was quickened by war, which was one of those lines right. That I was like curious to see more of.
To be clear, just for listeners, he doesn't think of, he goes into a whole long thing about why we now think of these as children's stories, but these are not properly understood as children's stories. Yeah.
And he also talks about like his frustration as a child when he'd be like learning about dragons or whatever. An adult would be like, oh, well, that's because old people back in the day, they didn't understand. So, they thought like a Komodo dragon was a dragon or whatever. And he's like, no, like I did not like being told these creatures were dragons. I can still re-feel the irritation that I felt in childhood at assertions of instructive relatives such as these. Snowflakes are fairy jewels or are more beautiful than fairy jewels. And children expect the differences they feel but cannot analyze to be explained by their elders or at least recognized, not to be ignored or denied.
Yeah, and he says it's a category error, right? Because the elder thinks that the kid needs to be instructed about what to believe in. And Tolkien says that for the kid, it's not a matter of belief. They want to know.
Right.
Right? Like they're not looking to be told what to believe. They want to know.
Right. And he's in, and so there's that like literary making, right? And like the power of language. He's like, when we take When we can take green from grass, blue from heaven, and red from blood, we have already an enchanter's power upon one plane. And the desire to wield that power in the world external to our mind awakes.
Yeah, just that was the part I was trying not to talk about before, because that was, I feel like I could talk for an hour about that. I think that's the most brilliant part of the whole essay, where he's talking about the relationship between adjective and incantation is just utterly brilliant.
I mean, the thing that sort of, and I wonder how much of the sort of allegorical tradition is in the background here. I'm guessing quite a lot, but the sense that enchantment as something one experiences in the world as a sort of feeling is inextricably tied to an account of meaningfulness in the world, where that fairy story, or in particular, either do well or reflect well insofar as things mean things. You know, we see red, and that is sort of linked to blood in a way that is not just a linguistic association or a sort of cultural convention. There are actual ontological links between certain kinds of appearances, certain kinds of natural realities, certain kinds of social realities, marriage, say, and a unified whole.
You know, there's a related but somewhat different point that Chesterton makes, where he's talking about, Chesterton asserts that fairy tales make us see the world more clearly than realist novels. He says, because they allow us to remember how strange the world really is. They make the rivers run with wine only to make us remember for one wild moment that they run with water. And Tolkien, because there are these like larger points that he's making about fairy stories and fantasy, but then there's also like the crafting of it, you know, and the importance of, you know, he talks about this soup. He has this idea of the soup of like over generations and centuries, people are like putting little elements into the soup, right? A story about an archbishop slipping on a banana peel, or a story about Charlemagne's mother. And he's like, things either get retained or left out of the soup because of their literary power. And so eventually, like, you have this long simmering broth that you can, like, you know, kind of ladle from and use. And there's a phenomenal review of any of you know Patrick Rothfuss? He's like a very popular modern fantasy writer. You know, he's quite good. And his big book is The Name of the Wind. And there's a review by Adam Roberts in Strange Horizons where he's comparing Rothfuss and Tolkien. And the point that he makes is that at the level of language, there's a huge difference. There's a bit from the Rothfuss. He gave me a look. "I'm sorry," I repeated, hoping I looked as guilty as I felt. "I forgot," Sim grimmed, shrugging it off. "It's not a big deal." And Roberts is like, this is the bourgeois discursive style, right? That bit could be from two modern characters in the present day. And like, why is he talking about guilt rather than shame, which might be a more apt mood for a world. And then he quotes from Tolkien's The Children of Húrin. "We're not afraid any longer," said Turin. "Not all of us. My father is not afraid, and I will not be, or at least as my mother, I will be afraid and not show it." It seemed then to Sador that Turin's eyes were not the eyes of a child, and he thought, "Grief is a hone to a hard mind." And that's way better, right? Like, it's way, way better. And it's way better at the syntax, right? Like, it registers on the style. He's not afraid of inversions. He's also inhabiting a different mindset. And so, like, the creation, because there's one bit in the essay where he's like, anybody can say, you know, the sun is green, right? Or I forget the color that he uses. But, like, to create a world where you believe that the sun is green, that is art at its like highest capacity, right? And it needs to register at every level down to the level of syntax. And the two things that he says really quickened his interest in fairy stories, one was war and the other was philology.
Yeah, the philology I find actually easier to understand than the war. I mean, even in a like anthropological sense, you know, you're looking at how languages emerged and divided, and then you're finding these common roots between words, and it's taking you back to a lost world where there was an original meaning of things that has been covered up by this like detritus and debris that has, you know, there's some occlusion that has occurred at the level of language that if you cut away the sort of weeds or the push away the mist of that occlusion, you get to the true essence of the word, which is the unified essence of the thing it's describing also. But Tolkien is talking about sub-creation a number of times, and it, you know, the relationship between the fairy story and the writer and God the creator is shot through in all of this. And at the level of language, I think part of what he's saying is that red blood, he talks about green grass in the essay, right? Once you can disaggregate the green from the grass, and this is this incredible part of the essay where he's like talking about the power of adjectives and the sort of the magic, you know, adjective is incantation. Once you can separate the green from the grass, now you can bestow that quality of greenness on things and you can mix it with something else. So like the green sun that he talks about, and he talks about in the context of the challenge for a writer is to create a world in which the green sun is credible and makes sense. But to do that, first you have to have been able to take the green from the grass and put that green from the grass on the sun in a sub-creator way.
But what's so interesting to me is that the act of sub-creation for Tolkien, it means that there's sort of more, there's theological truths about the sub-created world that are only legible through a kind of understanding of theological truth. And like, if there's a counterexample to the way that he talks about, you know, so I'll start us with a passage from this when Tolkien talks about, we've already talked about the beginning of this sentence, this paragraph, when we can take green from grass, blue from heaven, red from blood, we already have an enchanter's power. But then he has this interesting kind of follow-up. It does not follow that we shall use this power well upon any plane. We may put a deadly green upon a man's face and produce a horror. And there is a way in which there's something, a man's face being green, we're not in a kind of surrealist world where anything can be anything and it's freewheeling and the very strangeness of it speaks to the possibility of human ingenuity.
Matisse did it pretty well. Yeah.
But it's the associations that are being used, the connections are still there in the sub-created world for good, for ill. There's not a kind of neutrality there. As opposed to, I always think of Joris Carol Hismont, Against Nature. Weird little decadent novel, has this famous scene with what's called the mouth organ. So this dandy recluse that is living alone in seclusion with unlimited wealth and no human interaction starts to think that different liqueurs produce different sounds in his head, and he can play a symphony by drinking little bits of different liqueurs where the flavors evoke the sounds. But it's sort of allegorically chaotic. There's no meaning. It's just the meanings that he makes in his own head create the sort of internal symphony for him. And then he gets sick and converts to Catholicism. But I think that the allegorical sense of there being a link between colors and realities and primal associations, that is the artistic tradition within which I think the morally good, effectively good creator for Tolkien is working.
I have to disagree with also the Wiesmann being, people should read the novel. It's not that long. And I think that what Tolkien is describing is more like the technique of surrealism, which is a banality of derangement. I personally am, I always say, like, I think surrealism is so bad it could ruin a poet as great as Frank O'Hara. Like, the worst Frank O'Hara is when he's in his surrealist phase, and it's unreadable because it's just this sort of a repetition of the effect of like incongruous pairings and unnatural pairings. And I don't see the Wiesmann scene that way, but I'm not sure that what Tolkien is saying is that there needs to be a direct allegorical connection to what is natural. I think he's saying there needs to be a allegorical connection to what is true. And insofar as our perceptions of the natural can become ossified and covered up, that the derangement actually reveals to us that which is true in the natural that we're no longer able to see. So like Beckett quoting the Christian Bible says of Proust, right? He talks about what is habit but the dog chained to its vomit. And what is Proust doing? Like, what's happening with the smell of the Madeleine? It's the dog is unchained from its vomit. And it can be a smell, it can be a scene like the river of blood, but it It requires only like it. It can even approach perversity superficially to make you recognize that which is more true.
So I think we're agreeing. I think I agree with you. I think that the problem with the sort of surrealist mode, if that's the direction that we want to call it, is that it's not natural, nor do I think that Tolkien wants things to be natural. Exactly. I think that Tolkien's allegorical understanding of association does derive, in a sense, from theological truth. Or, you know, when we think of red and blood, we're thinking of Christ's blood to be sort of maybe too allegorical about it. But I think that the reality is that Tolkien has as fixed in truth can be played with in fiction, in the co-created world, precisely because of the relationship to making the truth strange. And he has that wonderful line, which I now need to look up, that's actually quite similar to the Chesterton that you read, Phil, about color. We need recovery. We should look at green again and be startled anew, but not blinded by blue and yellow and red. We should meet the centaur and the dragon, and then perhaps suddenly behold, like the ancient shepherds, sheep and dogs and horses and wolves. As in the Chesterton, there is a sense that what is unreal or untrue, or ostensibly unreal or untrue in a fairy story, simultaneously does have a relationship to truth. It's not just like, we know dragons aren't real, and therefore they're sort of instrumentalized in helping us recognize the reality of wolves, but rather a sense that enchantment is not simply something to be posited in the realm of the fictional or in the realm of the illusory, that there is a reconciliation or a return to the material real world that sort of complicates the distinction between the escape world, the fiction world, the true world of you know, God and Christ, and the world of materiality. That these worlds are completely in dialogue with each other.
There's even a line, he says, "The maddest castle that ever came out of a giant's bag in a wild Gaelic story is not only much less ugly than a robot factory, it is also, to use a very modern phrase, in a very real sense, a great deal more real." Now, you, Tara, there's a bit where you're talking about the Christian novel in one of your essays, and you write, like, it's subcreation, it's not creation, right? It's not like the artist is God, or and it must be one that embraces both its own givenness and the givenness of language itself. It must embrace the fact that language as a means of human communication wedded to human history is not and can never be fully free, let alone fully capable of accurate expression. It would understand language as at once communicative rather than authoritative and contingent, rooted in the patterns of our own speech, rooted in our own histories. And I wanted to take that compared with your last nonfiction book, because I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about fantasy and the difference between what Tolkien is doing here and asserting here and something like Harry Potter fandom. Or, and this is not a, like a slight on Harry Potter. I think that snooty literary types like to dismiss the Harry Potter books without like acknowledging just like her unbelievably wonderful capacity for like invention that is the reason those books are incredibly popular. Like, she's able to just generate these like fantastic images and ideas and things in this world that have a real kind of enchantment to them that is not purely analyzable, right? Though she's certainly not a prose writer like Tolkien, right? But it seems to be that like our modern relationship to these things feels much more acquisitive, right? Where rather than sort of understanding your relationship to art as being like embedded in this history and tradition that you approach with a certain amount of trepidation as well as ownership.
I'm always wary when the idea that, like, how do we relate originality and fantasies of originality to the question of being artistically downstream of, indebted to tradition, but particularly tradition when it comes in the form of the kind of fairy tale storytelling soup, to use Tolkien's word, which is, I think, the most intense version of, like, it's one of the most intense ways of thinking about tradition as something holistic and pervasive rather than just a series of codes or canons.
Yeah.
And I think there's the Ross Douthat approach, which is like, does I don't think is altogether wrong, which is to say, you know, contemporary culture is extremely decadent. And one of the reasons it's not, that we know that it's decadent, is that we have only sequels.
Yeah.
And that we don't have any new stories. At the same time, it feels that when one deals with the realm of fairy tale, when one deals with the realm of the soup, all stories are reinterpretations, reimaginings, revisioning of stock characters. So I think instinctively, like Ross Douthat is right, that there is something decadent and sad about infinite Marvel movies, but it doesn't seem to me to be reducible to the fact that we are using known characters and known tropes and wanting to play with them, figure out what they mean, figure out how tweaking something makes them new.
Yeah, like fairy tale, like people who study fairy tales will be like, this is subtype 13 of the, you know, this type of fairy tale, you know, mixed with elements from this. Like you can see the branches very clearly. And you know, like I even have like favorite, like there's like a Norwegian version of a fairy tale that appears in the Brothers Grimm, which is infinitely like my favorite version of that fairy tale, which appears in like 19 other versions, you know?
I've kind of lost track of like the latest Marvel movies. And like, I'm not really so in touch with the genre anymore, but I feel like the problem is not the returning to the same cauldron over and over again. The problem is the combination of the acquisitiveness Phil described with this sort of repetition of tropes. So it's like there's both a sort of desire, like a shallow sort of engine of novelty and repetition together. So the repetition never adds up to anything. It's never deepening anything.
Fan service feels different from tradition. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes, right. And that, I think fan that's service the, feels different from tradition.
It's like this thing I want to tease apart, because there's the fan service element. There's the intellectual property element, which I think is also
big
kind
part of it.
Part of the soup. Who is profit? And the question of repetition. And I'm curious. I feel like there's sort of two different ways that the acquisitive model that I'm wary of manifests itself in kind of contemporary fairy tale mechanics. And I think the more obvious one is like the fan service that you get from watching a Marvel movie, say, where it is because it is designed to make money and is designed to be on social media, and moments are designed as memes so that there's a sort of pointing and saying, ah, I expected that, or that character came in, such that the actual story being told, the actual characters being told aren't the point. The discourse about the thing being told is the point. You know, the films that seem designed for their role in the media cycle rather than to be experienced in and of themselves. But I think that there's sort of this, it would stand to reason that there's less worry about this in, say, Harry Potter fan fiction. You know, no one is making money off it. It's diffuse. There's a sort of freedom of storytelling. There's the freedom to take these characters and translate them into the realm of myth and reimagine them.
What was that? What was that New York Times ad? It was like it was an advertising series for the New York Times, and then one of them was here we go. Liana is imagining Harry Potter without its creator, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which you presumably is like related to the politics around J.K. Rowling and how for, but like we don't even need to get into that. It was just a peculiar, but felt like very kind of modern.
Yeah, like the imagining without the creator part, in a sense, doesn't give me pause as someone who's like interested in the theology of storytelling. What does give me pause, and I think it's very important to not lose sight of this, is that Harry Potter fandom basically came out of smut. Hmm. Like the fan fiction part of the fandom, that the sort of fan fictions were largely around romantic pairings and sexual pairings with characters that people wanted to see, or, you know, Harry didn't get with Hermione and therefore we have to remedy that, or, you know, Draco Malfoy didn't get with Hermione, we have to remedy that. And I think that it's something that's not to say every fan fiction is pornographic or every fan fiction is just smut, but that fan fiction didn't arise as a genre out of like, let's recover, write a story, tell a kind of new vision of the world, even though that is certainly possible. And I imagine it could be done very, very well. It arose out of how can I kind of fix this thing that I don't like and get a particular kind of dopamine hit from imagining certain kinds of sexual erotic situations so that it was itself a kind of fan service. And I'm curious whether the internet, my strong instinct, and I wrote about this in Strange Rights, is the very nature of internet culture allowing for certain kinds of dopamine hits by virtue of access to certain kinds of information or fulfillment or indeed
because
porn.
Harry Potter came out as internet access was growing.
Exactly. Like it was the first fandom that was able to be of the scale that only the internet would allow, that you could just sort of anyone could log on and find fellow Harry Potter fans and find fellow shippers of particular romantic pairings and kind of create community by sharing these alternate stories. And so fan service and the sort of idea of content as something that fulfills a very particular, and I think I would go so far as to say pornographic need. And I don't mean just that it was porn, but that the kind of need being fulfilled is, I want a hit of this. I want a hit of consummation that is at the dopamine level of my brain rather than at the level of the soul.
It leaves nothing unconsummated. I mean, I've written about what I would say is an analogous phenomenon in the development of mimetic or cybernetic ideologies. Like, I wrote about it in the context of the Boogaloo Boys, where you have what, okay, maybe superficially appears to just be ideologically incoherent, but is actually better understood as a kind of cybernetic phenomenon where there are social cybernetic phenomenon, where there are all of these people feeding in inputs into a kind of social feedback loop. You know, there are certain like unconscious or semi-conscious fantasies that are powering this, and collectively you can, you know, iterate towards these sort of unconscious drives and then project them onto the screen of this ideology, the Boogaloo Boys, whatever. And what this has in common with, I think, the kind of literary pornographic fan fiction is the instantaneous fulfillment of like a desire for, it's not just titillation, it's that the thing that may have previously lay inside your brain in a kind of generative, unconsummated idleness now has to be like fully worked out. And that then becomes a social thing also. But you're not doing this in private. You're collectively participating in this in a way that then iterates the fantasies that are being worked out and explicated, such that by the time you get to the end of the process, it's not even anyone's fantasy in particular anymore. It's some sort of weird egregore that's incarnating whatever this thing is. And all you Harry Potter fans, I don't mean anything against you particular weirdos. I'm just making a more general point, so don't come after me.
I have a huge Harry Potter fan in my house, and we have read those books with great delight.
I think it's fair to say, at least from a sort of tokenish standpoint, that like Harry Potter fanfic is incredibly disenchanted. And I think that precisely the reason it is disenchanted is because what you're saying, that the mysterious, unspoken, unconsummated thing or things, the kinds of mysteries that happen in Fairyland, in Tolkien's Fairyland, are part, like the mysterious element is that they are opening us up to something beyond our capacity to categorize. So reality is richer, it's more abundant, it's fuller than what we have the tools to grasp. So there's always the implication or the hope in a fairy story that the reality that is being pointed to is something that we might one day fully apprehend, do not yet now, but we're only seeing, you know, a tip of the iceberg. And so the fantastical is not unreal so much as a potential conveyor of an unknown real. But what the sort of pornographic fan service fantasy of any kind, sexual or IP fan servicey, does is say this thing, this unconsummated desire you have, let's A, appear to consummate it, explicate it, and reduce it. You know, what you really want is to see Harry and Draco bone. And the whatever feeling of terror, excitement, titillation is sort of implicit in your reading of the fantastical, we can explain away as a sexual desire that just like
desexualized sexual desire, because the end state of this is sterility, right? The opposite of fantasy is not reality, it's pornography. That's the opposition. And pornography, in making everything explicit in not just clinical anatomical detail, but like explicit in terms of leaving no unconsummated space for there to be a deeper, richer mystery, ultimately kills desire, kills fantasy, and results in a kind of appalling sterility. And so maybe I am directing this at all the Harry Potter weirdos. You should watch out.
But I think that there's an interesting thing here, because he talks about drama too, and he's opposed to drama. He thinks that fantasy and drama are...
Is he opposed to drama, or is he saying that fantasy doesn't work in drama?
He's saying that fantasy doesn't work in drama, sorry. That, you know, fantasy cannot be counterfeited. Drama is naturally hostile to fantasy. Because I was thinking about this in terms of, like, the Tolkien movies, right? Which I quite enjoyed. But there's a way in which in the movie, there's a certain amount of the strangeness or power that is just gone, where instead of being captured in this world that feels created even at the level of syntax, you're seeing a delightful sequence of fantastical forms before you. And I enjoyed it very much, but it didn't feel like fantasy in the way that Tolkien is talking about.
Okay, but did you see the Ralph Bakshi animated Lord of the Rings?
No, I haven't.
You should. Okay. It's amazing. You know, Ralph Bakshi is one of the, like, great animators of the 20th century.
Okay, because I was going to talk about Spirited Away. So, like, yeah. I feel like animation is a much better place for fantasy than human and CGI.
So what does Tolkien say? He says that fantasy has this advantage of resting strangeness. Is that the phrase he uses? Something like that, that it'd be like the fantasy world begins with a kind of resting strangeness, which animation has, and Bakshi's animation in particular, because okay. It's not trying to be realistic and has a sort of enchanted quality. It's amazing, man. The two animated movies when I was a kid that were like psychedelic experiences for me were Bakshi's Lord of the Rings and then The Last Unicorn.
I've never seen either of those.
Yes, where there's a clock, pendulum clock, and the unicorns go into the waves, like, totally flipped my wig and deeply, deeply enchanted. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, photography has a sort of, it's too explicit. Moving image is too overt. Animation is a kind of inherently enchanted medium.
Tactile and realistic. To quote Hayao Miyazaki, anime may depict fictional worlds, but I nonetheless believe that at its core it must have a certain realism. Even if the world depicted is a lie, the trick is to make it seem as real as possible. Stated another way, the animator must fabricate a lie that seems so real, viewers will think the world depicted might possibly exist.
I really like having kind of worked out in the course of this conversation and kind of convinced myself of this, that there's two things that the fairy tale is opposed to, and one is tragedy and one is pornography.
Yeah.
Tragedy and pornography may or may not be the same thing. Like, I think I'd have to go down a very 19th century deep dive rabbit hole to justify my intuition that there's a lot in common there. But I think that even holding them apart as two separate discursive ways of being in the world with moral and theological implications, the fairy tale seems to be a bulwark both against certain kinds of despair, like especially for Tolkien, like post-Nietzschean, post-Schopenhauerian sense of the only way to be real is to look clear-eyed upon the collapse and meaninglessness of existence and stand alone above it, as opposed to a kind of joyful acceptance of the abundance of reality.
Yeah.
And then that same approach of mystery, of openness and joy to an abundant reality being the thing that separates fantasy from pornography, which is, again, kind of nihilistically, everything is explicable and reducible to, like, kind of not uninteresting biological acts of release.
You could say one more thing, like a distinction within the moral realm. So leave pornography out of it for a second. Because tragedy is supposed to be morally instructive, right? And so you could say that the morality of tragedy is didactic, whereas the morality of fantasy is evocative. And so it's insofar as each of them, in principle at least, is or can be moral, can contain a moral element, that like it's different forms of morality. And fantasy, you know, like you think of didactic fantasy and it's like a contradiction in terms. It would mean that it failed, like if it was didactic, it's a failure as art. Whereas the same is not true of tragedy. You could have a successful tragedy that also is more overtly morally instructive.
Sure. I don't know that tragedy is morally instructive. I'm curious where you see
it's supposed to force you to confront your fate, right? And like so that the confrontation morally instructive is maybe too strong. It's not necessary. You're not necessarily supposed to become like if we're taking it in the classical sense, then there's not necessarily a religious moral progress, but there is an edifying confrontation or an ennobling confrontation with fate. And so there is a clear sort of outcome in that sense. Whereas with fantasy, I think like if you get lost in it and learn nothing in particular with it, learn nothing in particular from it, but its images linger and like it's the world that has been created, if that environment lingers in some way, that's enough. It's like, this is what the Romantics thought was so great about myth, right? That there is something not formally expressible through language or through rational syllogism. There's some layer of meaning in the universe that can't be expressed verbally, syllogistically, logically, can only be experienced in the sort of unity of like images that evoke meanings. And that's what myth is supposed to be. And fantasy is a kind of mythic terrain where if the image lingers, I think it's done its job. I don't know if Tolkien would agree with that, but that's how I see it.
Should we go on to Goblin Market? Jake, you were saying this is your first encounter with Goblin Market and you were not prepared.
Yeah, it is. And I had read some Rossetti years ago in a class on Victorian poetry, so I thought I knew a little bit about her, but this was unexpected. It is a long poem. It is a narrative poem. It has a cast of characters, two sisters, a fruit seller, let us say, and it is stylistically varied, like rhythmically, rhyme scheme wise. It like alternates between. I don't know exactly what to say about it. It's about. Well, there are two sisters.
Weird sex stuff. About weird sex stuff.
It's absolutely about weird sex stuff. Like, the levels to which it's about weird sex stuff go off in... It might be about rape. It might be about carnal temptation.
Never mind my bruises. Hug me, kiss me, suck my juices. Squeezed from goblin fruits for you. Goblin pulp and goblin dew. Eat me, drink me, love me. Laura, make much of me. For your sake, I have braved the glen and had to do with goblin merchantmen.
So I should say, because I did go read some criticism about this because I wasn't sure what to make of it, frankly, and I wanted to see if I could, you know, read something that would open it up to me for. And there's an interpretation that the goblins, who are, you know, these sellers of fruit, there's one interpretation.
Let's give a basic plot summary. So it begins morning and evening, maids heard the goblins cry, "Come buy our orchard fruits, come buy, come buy." And there are two sisters, and one of them is Laura, who bowed her head to hear, and the other is Lizzie, veiled her blushes, crouching close together. Okay, so Laura's like, "We must not look at the goblin man. We must not buy their fruits." And there was some other woman who tried the goblin fruits, and then she died, and no grass grows on her grave.
Poor Jeannie.
Yeah, poor Jeannie. It's rough. One of the sisters, she just can't resist. She goes to the goblin men. They demand that she pay something. She doesn't have any money, so she gives them a lock of her hair and a tear. And she eats the goblin fruits, and she takes home, a kernel stone from one of the fruits. And then she, longs for the taste of these fruits again. But she can't hear their cry, right? Only her sister can hear their cry. And she starts to wither away. Her sister realizes what happened to her and goes to the goblins because she wants to buy fruit. They don't want to give her fruit to give to her sister. They want her to try the fruit. And there is this extremely intense scene where they try to force her to eat, right? Lizzie uttered not a word, would not open lip from lip, lest they should cram a mouthful in, but laughed in heart to feel the drip of juice that syruped all her face and lodged in dimples of her chin and streaked her neck, which quaked like curd. And then she goes back, not having secured the fruit, but she's covered in fruit juice. And so she goes back to her sister, and that's that line, "Hug me, kiss me, suck my juices," that I read, which, "Eat me, drink me, love me," which one of the commentary was like, "Oh, she's like Christ." And I was like, I mean, okay. a little bit. That's not what I was first thinking of.
That seems to be not an uncommon interpretation.
Right.
I read that in a few places. I think that might have been the canonical 19th century interpretation, in fact.
Yeah, I don't think it's not there.
Certainly not the first thing that's there, you know?
Yeah, it's not the primary impact of the scene for me. Maybe that's because I'm a debased 21st century man. So then she kissed her with a hungry mouth. And then as she's kissing her, her lips begin to scorch and the taste of the fruit is like wormwood, like bitter to her. And then that heals her of the desire for the fruit. And then days, weeks, months afterwards, they're both wives with children of their own. And they'll tell their children, there's no friend like a sister, you know?
Yeah, it's not a great ending. The ending's
amazing. Just there was nothing weird. Everything you read was just a nice story about sisterly love.
Did you think that because when I got to the end, I thought to myself, I wondered, was this a sort of contrivance, something that Rossetti felt she had to put on to?
I had the same thing.
It kind of reads like that.
That it is what they tell. You could read it as it's the story they tell themselves.
Oh, it's this. That hadn't occurred to me. That's interesting. But even that, it's the story they tell themselves. But even that would require that they had gone through some sort of unexplained change from the people they are poem prior to that. All of that hungering has just disappeared, and now this is who they are suddenly at the end without any explanation.
It's not who they are. It's just what they say to their kids.
Right. But yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I don't know, Tara, I'm fascinated. What do you think? I need some help here.
Also, by the way, was this poem influential to you when you were writing your own two sisters, one of whom is more?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, and also, I think Laura, the name Laura from the protagonist of The World Cannot Give, also came from this poem.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, yeah.
Or a little bit of Laura, there's this Laura, and then there's Laura in Carmilla. So I just sort of, Laura is a good name for someone in a weird psychosexual sapphic relationship. But yes, the two sisters, and one of them has to go to the mysterious otherworldly creatures to rescue her own sister. Avalon takes it in a very different direction, but that's absolutely the setup I wanted to play with. But I will say something that's really interesting and only kind of came to me in this most recent reading of Goblin Market is whatever the implicit rules of magic in this poem. So we know, and this is where I think the Christian, even though the sex stuff is more palpable, I don't think it's a fig leaf to talk about this as a Christian understanding of magic and the supernatural or a Christian story. And the reason is, what would we know about the goblin fruit? The goblin fruit is addictive. You eat it once and then you hunger it forever to the point where you die.
It's the forbidden fruit.
Yes. But when we get more of it for Laura, when Lizzie gets it for Laura, it doesn't have the same effect a second time. It doesn't like sate her hunger and then she, you know, the next day she needs more fruit. It's worn off. Whatever Lizzie has done in bringing her the fruit and not eating it herself has changed the character of the fruit so that it now tastes bitter. Laura is healed of her addiction to the fruit. She no longer wants the fruit. She's no longer wasting away. So something about Lizzie's sacrifice, Lizzie's ordeal, even though she doesn't necessarily seem to know that that's what will happen, there is a vague sense that the goblins know, maybe Lizzie knows, that the character of the fruit is transformed from addictive to curative. Lizzie has done or worked some kind of magic or change.
Yeah.
And I think that
a sacrificial magic, essentially.
Yeah.
Because like when she tries it, like the impact upon her, she has this like cataclysmic reaction, like a watchtower of a town which an earthquake shatters down like a lightning-stricken mask, like a wind-uprooted tree spun about like a foam-topped waterspout, cast headlong in the sea, she fell at last, pleasure past and anguish past. Is it death or is it life?
Yeah, I have to say, for a poem of its length, it's fun to read. The meter, like the line-to-line quality of it is wonderful. I found myself like at points in the story or in the drama of it, I had a harder time with that than I did with the verse, only because I felt stupid for reading it in primarily in the psychosexual way. And I get like the sacrificial quality of it, but also there does seem to be a fairly straightforward erotic dimension that is paired with the, I don't know if it's the Christian reading of it, but it's not like ultimately resolved by it. I don't know. It's not less luridly psychosexual, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, especially the eat me, drink me, love me. I feel like out of context, very easy to think of this as like one of the goblin eat my fruit sex stuff. But this is already like post-sacrifice, not corrupted or seemingly not corrupted Lizzie, covered in goblin juices, using this incredibly sexual language, even as the magic seems to work as sacrificial magic. But like, so what is, and this is something that I'm not sure about as I keep like, I'm looking at this poem now over and over again, looking at it in the preparation of this conversation, where does the magic happen? Like, what is it that Lizzie, it can't just be that Lizzie does not get seduced by the goblins insofar as her language reflects the seduction of the goblins when she's back and saying, hug me, kiss me. So it seems to be in that climactic moment of Laura like kissing Lizzie. And it's also kind of unclear from the text, is she kissing Lizzie to suck her juices? Or is she mourning her sister's fate, thinking that her sister has indeed eaten the goblin fruits?
I hadn't even considered the second interpretation. I thought it was...
It's not clear. Laura runs up to Lizzie and says, Lizzie, have you tasted for my sake the fruit forbidden? And are you ruined in my ruin? She clung about her sister, kissed and kissed and kissed her, and then more kissing, with a hungry mouth. It does not appear that she is kissing her sister to suck the juices off her face. It appears at least to be mourning her sister and like embracing her as a sister and not as a goblin juice tree.
I thought she was, right. I see that now. I had just naturally read it as her seeing her as like a vessel of goblin juice.
Oh, I always did. Until reading it again. And then went, wait, it doesn't stay either way.
The question you're asking is where and how and what is the magic that is being performed and who exactly is being spared and by... Spared of what and by what?
It's completely unclear. And yet it feels like we are satisfied as readers, at least I am, that it works but it is, we are not satisfied as readers with what they tell their children.
Yeah.
And I think you guys are completely right that the fact that it's framed as what they tell their children indicates to us that if there is a sense of dissatisfaction, it's meant to be there. You know, this is not Rossetti telling us this. We end with another story being told.
Yeah. And there's no shame for the final, like, consummation, right? Like, you shouldn't have gone with the goblin men, but, like, it's intensely sexual, right? And you can read that, like, you know, the reaction that she has to the goblin juice is sort of orgasmically. And it's a celebrated scene, right? You know, complicatedly celebrated. I did think it was interesting. After composing this, she volunteered at Highgate Penitentiary.
There's a notable lack of shame throughout.
Yeah.
Like, whatever is Absolutely. Happening here, it's not a story about characters. These are not women who are suffering consciously or penitent over desires they consider. It's not psychological, for one thing, right? And I guess fantasy is not psychological. Right. So so it's not about what they're experiencing psychologically. It's about what's happening through them. And shame is not what's happening.
I mean, what's important seems to be not sensual pleasure. Well, sensual pleasure is obviously very important in the story. But like in terms of you're talking about the mechanism of the magic, it's not the desire for sensual pleasure that seems to be the issue. One of them is like commerce, and one of them is gift, and that seems, and sacrificial gift, and that seems much more important, right?
Yeah, I was saying before, there is a reading of this that I just came across today, so I don't know how I didn't read enough to see whether it seemed credible even in my, you know, cursory knowledge of this, but there's a reading of it as a kind of critique of like a Victorian commerce and Victorian advertising, which instinctively seemed late, you know, I think it came out in like the 90s was the first. It seemed instinctively very like sort of late 20th century reading back into this. But maybe that's there.
But it is. I mean, they don't take her money. They fling back the penny.
Yeah.
Because she won't eat the fruit.
Right.
And then there's this the only sort of hint we have is like Lizzie's on her way back after this is happening, before she hasn't gotten home to Laura yet. Lizzie went her way, knew not was it night or day, sprang up the bank, tore through the firs, threaded copse and diggle, and heard her penny jingle, bouncing in her purse. Its bounce was music to her ear. It's a strange little aside because it doesn't really seem to be part of this psychosexual juice story. But like the only indication that we get that she has some sense of the efficacy of what has happened is the fact she still has her penny. It's not very much money. Clearly something else is at play here. It feels sort of unsatisfying. Like I don't like as a reader, that line feels unsatisfying and kind of silly. But it does seem that the fact that they don't have her penny is part of the tangle of gestalt. The tangled gestalt of allegorical truths that we're trying to work out in order to, although I now that we've had the conversation about Harry Potter fanfiction, like are we just going to pornography Goblin Market further by explaining it away.
Right, but there's a difference between erotics and pornography, right? And yeah, and I think the fact that like we're sort of like intrigued and troubled and just kind of want to keep going back to this is kind of a clue. You know what you got out of pornography, right? And this is definitely like intensely erotically charged, but it feels like it's doing something deeper.
But I think it's precisely the fact that we can't reduce. All of us are pretty convinced by the efficacy of what has happened between the sisters. We're not coming away, we're maybe just dissatisfied by the final stanza, but we're not coming away going, why did that work? Like that shouldn't have worked. She should have died. And we do not believe that there is efficacy in the rescue, even as we can't quite pin down the sex part, the sacrifice part, the money part.
No, I think that's right. There's some overpowering transference that occurs that you can't quite make sense of, but is credible within the atmosphere of the story, definitely. That part didn't bother me at all. That part, made the most sense within the logic of the story.
I just really like it. It's every time I read it, I'm like, it's so weird.
It's very weird, like line to line, even the throwaway lines, like, I don't know, the penny jingling. It's long enough that you have to make allowances for there being sort of lines that just like work in the meter or that are competently satisfying the scheme of the poem. It's enough for me. And aside from that, there are some really wonderful, enchanting lines in it. And I enjoyed it. I'm still thinking about it. I guess that's it doing its work. But I definitely, when I was done reading it, felt like there was something I had missed, but also that like the level on which I was seeing it work, which admittedly was like definitely the psychosexual level, was all there. None of that was a misreading, but that maybe it added up to something that I hadn't fully grasped.
Yeah. Which is the sign that it's a success, you know, in Tolkien's view.
Yeah, it's interesting to read the text immediately after the manifesto. So I think, like I said, I have a lot of experience with this particular poem. It inspired Avalon. It inspired other, you know, work I've done. And yet it's only kind of looking at it in the light of what exactly is fantasy doing, particularly sort of Christianly tinged fantasy from the 19th century onward, with its sort of these questions of recovery and primality. And I buy the fact that the goblin market is a market is also part of it too. Mm. They are advertising their wares, but they're not advertising in a city exactly. There is a side of, they are both primal and commercial beings. And that does seem to be part of what interests me so much about 19th century and post-19th century fantasy, is this question of what is true and how does that relate to quote-unquote modernity. And I think that that is as true in Goblin Market as it is in Tolkien's essay, that there's always a question of what are the old laws kind of underpinning new things or seemingly new things. And the advertisement of the goblin fruit does seem to have this twofold character as a specter of contemporary advertisement and also something that is happening in the old and ancient world. And am I right in thinking we don't really exactly know when Goblin Market is taking place?
Yeah.
There's no indication either that this is, you know, Chipping Norton in 1830 or we are in, you know, a mysterious medieval world.
It's the names are something of a clue, right? I think, but yeah, other than that, nothing to directly anchor you in a particular time.
Yeah.
Spooky stuff.
Tara, this is fantastic. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I was delighted to be on. This is my perfect morning thinking about fantasies and fairies. I have to go work on my new, very, very early stages novel after this.
Exciting.
Wonderful. We'll look forward to it.
Thank you both so much for having me on.
Thanks, Tara.
And from that point of view, it's most improbable that anyone will ever know exactly who is enjoying the shadow of whom.
I've given our objector his fair share of program time.
When these men talk, I never know whether to regard him as a man of genius or as an ape of genius.